Station WEAF, New York. The following program may be interrupted for news flashes as they are made available. It is now 1 p.m. GRUEN, Gruen Precision Watch Time. An ideal watch time.
Mama, I'm glad where you don't have to worry. And then you were ashamed because you knew she wasn't not that kind of person. She worried for all the right things. She believed in her faith and in a good fight. Her worrying would be the right way. You turned on the radio, you turned it off. You heard a hymn. You were wishing they'd play Beautiful Isle somewhere. Beautiful Isle. We live anew, land of the true. They read your favorite psalm, that one about not being afraid of the terror by night. You thought you heard them talking about those great lines in England, standing there patiently, orderly, waiting to give their blood for the boys who would be wounded. You thought, I wonder if the Red Cross would take my blood right now. And then you remembered with relief war bonds. At least you could buy one, two, as many extra war bonds as you could. But you still wanted to give your blood. Maybe save a boy's life. That was the thing your heart wanted. And then again that prayer, oh God. God, take care of him. What a day. Invasion day, a day out of time. I listened all day to our station. NBC, I was proud of NBC. I don't think I've ever been prouder of belonging to an organization. All day long, not a commercial. All day long, prayers, hymns, stirring music, and these reports coming in. All day long. It was something I can never forget. The voices of our friends. Bob St. John, Caesar Searching, Don Goddard, John W. Vandercook, Robert Danton, who's right here now, whose boy is over there somewhere. Right there, isn't he, Bob?
Yes, he is. Right there.
The captain?
Yes, and soon to be a major.
Bless his heart.
Well, that's what I did yesterday.
And you were reading the news?
Yes, at that moment, a flash was handed me. Of course, we never have time to look the flashes over. Possibly it's just as well. But when it said that there are 11,000 planes flying out to make this tremendous invasion, why, of course, I had my boy right up there in the sky with me.
Yeah.
I know. It's probably, I think, the longest prayer ever said in less than a second.
The prayer you said?
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Maybe a comma.
Well, I think it was the one I said, isn't it? God, take
just
care
that.
Of them. Take care of all of them, God. Please, God. Ben Ames Williams, our guest today, said almost a year ago, was it a year ago when you were on with us? Well, anyway, whenever it was, you had predicted shortly before that there would be a great many books that would have a religious angle, that people would go back to religion. And, you know, in reading your book, that we're going to talk about later today, Lever to Heaven, I marked one place where the man breathed just your kind of prayer, Bob Danton. It's curious, isn't it, what's taking possession of all of us. Irreligious, is there a word, irreligious? Unreligious. Unreligious men and women suddenly are praying. Sometimes they don't know what they're praying. But they know why. They know why. It's because they've got to have something more than is in themselves, something more that's in this world around us. They've got to have it. And so they prayed. And there was Bob Danton. And all of this was coming out. Remember, Bob, the day we had the nationwide broadcast?
Yes.
About the preparations. And there they were, just as we'd said they'd be.
Those same men that are sitting right here where we are now.
John Vandercook over there somewhere.
Bill Chaplin.
Yes.
St. John.
Yes. And Brooks, Bill Brooks, I suppose, up at least 48 hours without sleep, wasn't he?
You have no idea. I kind of wish that you might have been there in our newsroom as this business went on.
Do you know why I didn't come? I longed to come, but I was afraid of being a nuisance.
I don't think that you ever could be a nuisance.
Well, I was just afraid that it would be one more person, but I could picture every bit of it. The tickers going, men in their shirt sleeves rushing around, their eyes gaunt and weary, but going on and on.
Mary Margaret, you never would have been a nuisance, and don't take this in an uncomplimentary way, but I don't believe anybody there knew that anybody else was there.
I see. Well, that's how you knew I wouldn't be a nuisance. That takes me down a notch or two. Well, tell anything about it, Bob, that you want to say.
Well, to give a picture of the coverage, the invasion coverage, as it is from an announcer's point of view, it's very seldom that we knew exactly where we were going until within maybe 5 seconds. And sometimes while we were reading bulletins, we'd have to pick up a phone in one hand and we'd get a cue from Ed Schneider of the special events.
Bless
Mr.
his
Brooks.
Heart.
Bless
He's
his,
one of my favorites.
A monument to that boy, let me tell you. And he very calmly, in the midst of all this, I won't say it's confusion, but tenseness is a weak word, he'd say, job 24, go to London, Bob. I don't know what for. Go to London, 24. London, then maybe they wouldn't come through. Then Elmer Peterson or Robert St. John would suddenly, I'd look over there and they were sitting beside me, and I'd calmly turn the microphone over to them. And then they would fill in the necessary time. And all in all, I think the thing went off beautifully. I don't know how they did it.
No.
Nobody, the public has no idea of the immensity of the preparations and of the actual soul-killing work that those men went through. I'm not speaking of the announcers now.
No, you're talking about the newsroom.
Yes.
And all those men.
That desire to bring it to the people, to get it to them as accurately and as honestly as they possibly could. I give great credit to them for it.
Oh, well, I just think it was thrilling. It couldn't have been more so. And then last night when I heard Fred Waring.
Oh, that is perfect.
Doing the battle hymn, Vincent.
Oh, yes.
And then doing The Time Is Now.
Mm-hmm.
The Time Is Now. It must have been as stirring as our party. I'll never admit anything could have been more exciting and stirring than our party, but he had 1,000 veterans in his theater. I heard. I mean, 1,000 boys.
That's true.
I didn't mean veterans. Well, maybe they were at that. It seemed to me that's what they said. But I thought of servicemen. That is what I was thinking. Well, isn't it? Were you listening, Ben Ames Williams?
No, I wasn't listening. It didn't seem necessary.
You just knew.
You had the feeling that you were together with so many millions of people in the world, whether you were listening or not.
Yes.
The feeling of unity in the world yesterday was the thing that struck me more than anything else.
And the churches. The people in the churches. Women with work-scarred hands, all alone. Here a serviceman and his wife or sweetheart, you couldn't tell, one still here, you know, all praying. I don't know, what do you think has happened to the world? It's in great travail and it turns to something?
Well, that has always been true, of course. The old saying, the devil was sick, the devil was saint would be.
Mm-hmm.
The devil was well, the devil was saint was he. When we're in trouble, we turn to some power and look for help. That's the thing which is instinctive in us all today, the submission to a power which we can't define. We can only be sure it's there because we know we need it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have learned by experience that when we need things badly enough, we usually get them one way and another.
Yes.
That sense of submission to an outside power.
You say that and leave her to heaven.
Do I? Well, I've forgotten.
Let me see. May I just read that one little bit? I put down the number of the page, at least I hope I did. You always think you put things down, and then you have them. 412, I think, is the one that I wanted. You remember anything about Ben Ames Williams, Vincent?
I remember his last appearance here with pleasure.
Do you remember that he was born in Missouri?
No.
You can't, were raised in... Oh, Mississippi. How could I have made such a mistake, and me from Missouri?
That's a terrific mistake.
Yeah. Well, then you went to Ohio, didn't you?
Yes.
And then you went to Boston. Yeah. I'm right on those. And you were a newspaper man there. And I remember you're saying that whenever you got to writing in a rut, you wrote another way, even if magazines wouldn't take it. Say that something like the Saturday Evening Post had taken everything in the world that he wrote for a long time. Then he began to write a different kind of thing. That takes courage.
No, it resulted simply from the fact that I didn't want to be bored.
Or it bores you to write in the same way or to sell to the same.
Very tedious to keep doing something you know you can do.
Of course, I have to tell you what Annie Laurie Williams, our favorite agent, said to me today. Said, you know what? I've just sold Lever to Heaven. That's Ben Ames Williams' latest book that's out today for $100,000 to the... And I don't remember.
She told me about it, too, to Fox.
To Fox. Did she just tell you today?
No, I knew about it before.
You knew about it before. Well, having said that, I will now read you what he says about... This is his hero, who sat on the edge of the bed thinking what his life had been. And at last, without realizing the strangeness of his own action, it was a thing he'd never done before. He knelt, his head pressed on his crossed arms. He prayed no formal prayer, yet his thoughts shaped humble, grateful words. I've made as many mistakes as most men, he said to God. Probably I've made more. But Ruth, that's his wife, loves me, so I'm the richest of men. Nothing can take that away from me, and having her love, I'll go through whatever's coming and never damn my luck. I'll need help, need all the help I can get to be what I want to be to her, but I'll do the best I can. And then, you say, humility and surrender brought him peace. And he who had lain wakeful through the dark night, there on his knees beside the bed, disordered by his tossing, slept for a while as a child sleeps, his head pillowed on his arms. And yet he was in terrific trouble.
Yeah, he was in a tough spot.
He was in a very tough spot at that moment. And so, Bob Danton, we're wishing your boy all the luck there is, and he'll be in every prayer that I say from now till the end.
Aren't you lovely? Thank you very much.
He often has done our station breaks or announcements. What is they call them? Vincent?
Station identification.
And he has red hair, and I like him a lot. Red hair is my favorite kind of hair. And red hair is lucky. I wonder if his boy has red hair.
I don't know.
Well,
he's left us now for the moment.
Yes, he's left us now. Well, come on. You know the thing about you, Ben Ames Williams, I don't know what to do with you. You have the doggonest ability to create a character, a perfectly loathsome person in many ways. And then you go to reading about this terrible woman, and there you are, yourself, me. Bits and pieces of her are me. And I'll bet everybody who reads about her will have that same awful, shocked, horrified, worried feeling. Those are mild words to what I felt.
Well, that's an entirely new point of view for me, and it never had occurred to me that anybody would recognize herself in...
Well, I only mean in parts. I hope that I would never be quite what your Ellen is. Ellen is the... Well, tell how you happened to write this book about the seven deadly sins.
Well, this is... As I've said before, this is a book about the eighth deadly sin. I started many years ago with a vague idea that I might write a series of novels or magazine stories, each one dealing with one of the seven deadly sins. But as I said to some people in Boston the other day, when I came to Gluttony and Sloth, I thought I was getting too personal, so I gave it up.
I wouldn't exactly call you slothful. I don't... how many books have you written?
Well, I think about 33 or 4 stories have kind of been published as books. But, of course, I've written a great many magazine serials, which might
yes,
as well have
you've
been
not books. Exactly been lazy. Such books as The Strange Woman, that's another one of those women. And Come Spring, and Threads of Scarlet, The Strumpet Sea, and Splendor. And, you know, I don't know Amateurs at War at all.
That's a very fine book. But I didn't write it. I just wrote an introduction to that.
Oh.
And some introductions to the things that are in it. That's a bunch of first-hand accounts of the way Americans have fought in this and in other wars.
Really?
And my function was just to tell why the battles were fought and how they were fought so people would understand what they were reading about.
Well, now go on about the eighth deadly sin.
Well, eventually I decided to write a book about jealousy and... I wrote this book in rather a curious way. I set out with the idea it might be a psychological novel. But it became obvious that in this extreme type of personality, melodrama was almost sure to come along. So in the first draft of this book, the first 400 or 500 pages perhaps consisted largely of my explaining to the reader what the characters were thinking when they didn't say certain things. And then I cut all that out after I got it clear in my own mind and just let the characters do and say those things without explanation, hoping that the reader would be able to understand them as well as I did without any explanations.
That's it. I understand them all too well. That woman who was willing to lie or almost anything to dramatize herself and to have her way, your Ellen.
Yeah, she was willing to do almost anything.
Yeah.
Anything, as far as I can tell.
Well, he said, leave her to heaven means that she defied every natural law. She was able to escape all the penalties.
Did you recognize the quotation, by the way? We neglected to put that in the book. Do you know where it comes from?
You know that I'm ashamed to say I don't exactly,
well,
but it was very familiar to
me. Mrs. Williams discovered it when we were groping around to try to get a decent title. It's in what Hamlet's father says to him in the second appearance, I think. He says, in effect, as for your mother, you remember Hamlet's mother had misbehaved in various ways. As for your mother, contrive against her not. Leave her to heaven and to the thorns which in her bosom lies to prick and sting her. So that it really fits this book.
Well, it's too bad you didn't put it right in.
We hope to do that in the second 400,000.
Yes, the second million. Vincent, did you recognize it?
No, I didn't. Like you, it sounded familiar to me, and
yes.
I couldn't place it.
I just thought I would have said Shakespeare, I guess. I always say Shakespeare, the Bible, because it's very,
very,
it's very
the best
safe.
Yeah.
It's very, very safe. I wish, though, that you'd blow some of the cobwebs out of our brains by telling a little about that ranch. I had a feeling it was a real ranch that you knew, where you saw the turkeys and where you saw the wild horses.
It is. I went out there in 1928 or thereabouts with a group of friends on a visit to the place and went out again the following summer and knew it very intimately. And as you may gather, it made quite a strong impression on me. Out in the New Mexican mountains, just about as I described.
And their horses is wild?
I think now, as a matter of fact, that whole ranch has been given to the Boy Scouts of America so that they have a wonderful place.
You made those turkey gobblers sound bigger than any turkeys that I ever saw.
I never forget how big they looked the day I saw them coming down the canyon. I shot one of them myself and almost dropped dead running to catch him, just as the fellow in the book did.
They're wild turkeys.
Oh, yes, they're wild turkeys.
And how many are in a flock?
Well, there are about six in that particular group. Mm-hmm. The one I shot weighed about 25-26 pounds. Big bird.
Mm-hmm. And they were so remote from human beings that it took a good deal to startle them, didn't it?
No, they're quite shy. As I suggest in the book, I was alone on this occasion. Ellen was not with me. I lay there very quietly for a couple of hours waiting for them to come along, and lay even more quietly after they came in sight until they did come here. Kenneth Roberts was with me that day, but he was in another spot further down the canyon. And I got the shot before the turkeys got to him. So he came up and helped me get the bird on the horse and so on.
Well, Kenneth Roberts was with you, not Ellen. This is an actual scene in the novel. Yes, I prefer Kenneth for you, too. Charles Francis Cole was on our program the other day, and he said that you and Kenneth Roberts, or you at least, started him writing fiction.
Well, that isn't true, because before I ever met Charlie, he had written 3.5 million words of fiction, all of which he had sold, and that's quite a lot of fiction for anyone.
Well, I thought you'd be glad to know that he was giving you credit anyhow. I think it's Kenneth Roberts that he takes the credit for starting to write fiction.
Well, I don't think that's true either.
Listen, are you going to?
Kenneth wrote fiction long before he ever met Charlie.
What am I going to do about this?
I don't know. Take it up with Mr. Coe, I guess.
Yeah,
I'll tell you, one of the most interesting things about Charlie is that you enjoy everything he says, regardless.
We certainly did. I heard from his publishers today, and they said that they'd had more letters on the program than he did with us than almost anything.
Oh, he's a wonderful fellow.
Boy, I wanted him to come to my birthday party because I said, you really have wrestled, haven't you, in the garden? Well, he said, not that garden, but the other one. And then later he told me, now, after all, why have you got to bring that up? I'm a writer now, he said.
It's a wonder he didn't say no, but in the Garden of Eden, it would have been just like...
No, he didn't. You want to talk a little about Ellen?
No,
you think
said
she's
all
an exception,
I have to say about
you?
Her.
You mean it's in Leave Her to Heaven?
Yeah.
You're just leaving it to the prospective purchasers to go out and buy Leave Her to Heaven and
see,
read about it.
See, it's a year or more since I finished the book, and so I'm a little stale on it.
Would you care to have me tell you about Ellen?
I'd be delighted. I'd like to get the dispassionate point of view on her.
Well, she's simply beautiful. He meets her, the hero of this book, meets her on a train, and his description is full of words like frankincense and myrrh, at least the feeling of frankincense and myrrh, and skin that the blood is right underneath, rushing.
You've got me blushing now.
I'll fix you. I'll really fix you. You won't talk about your heroine? All right, I'll talk about your heroine. And you can tell he's fallen for her, but he has that little feeling. He can sense in her, perhaps, this passionate intensity that is going to try to wreck his life. And she thinks he looks like her father, who's dead, and she had this jealous absorption in her father. You know one of the scenes in the book that when he's with his children and he comes upon them, she comes upon her scattering the ashes of her father. And you describe it so beautifully. She rides a horse wonderfully, this Ellen, and she's hugging to her bosom as a woman would a child, this container where the ashes of her father are, and she's scattering them it must have looked like a frieze of old where a sower going out to sow, and she's scattering these ashes. And you think that she doesn't know anybody in the world is watching her, and then later it comes out that she knew all the time that he was there, and so she, even after all the ashes are scattered, she scatters a few more, or pretends to. There's a key to Ellen, don't
she's
you think?
Putting
that's
on
it?
An act.
Sure, she was always putting on an act. And yet she was, her jealousy and her intense love, if you could call it love, they were real, weren't they?
They seemed so to me when I was writing the book.
Would it hurt your feelings if I would say that it seems to me you make much worse women than you do men? Worse in the sense of they're such dreadful women. Well, look at the strange woman. Now, you know that she was not a pleasant woman. You haven't forgotten her, have you?
No, I haven't forgotten her. Mm-hmm. I don't think I will. No. Because people keep asking me where I found her and keep asking Mrs. Williams what sort of a man I must be to write about such people.
Keep
asking my friends what kind of woman Mrs. Williams must be for me to write about such people.
Well, I just think you knew them all before you knew her. Anyway,
well, I've known her since we were 16. So
you have? Isn't he baffling?
He certainly is. He gets out of things beautifully.
Can you think of any measures I can use with him, Vincent?
No, I can't offhand.
No, I think that Mrs. Williams is like Ruth in Leave Her to Heaven.
Yes, she is.
I felt that very much because you created the beautiful character in Ruth. Ruth is the...
There's an interesting thing. Now, you've talked quite a lot about Jenny in The Strange Woman and about Ellen in this book, but this is the first time you've mentioned Ruth.
Because Ruth, after all, is subordinated to Ellen. Now, don't tell me she
isn't.
The
real answer is that the unpleasant women are much more interesting to you and to the reader than the pleasant ones, isn't it?
So that's why you...
That's why you prefer books about unpleasant women.
Well, I don't know. You have me there, Ben Ames Williams. It's true. But I still think that it's the way you've written Leave Her to Heaven. Ruth, after all, she's an adopted sister of Ellen's. And she comes into the book in just that way that an adopted sister would. Everybody asks her to do things. She's cheerful and kind and obliging and never suspects the worst about anybody. But those are not as dramatic, are they?
Like the old saying that a newspaper can't come out with a headline saying no news today.
Well, that's perfect.
It's only when abnormal things happen that the outsider is interested.
What was it you said? As a younger man, you thought that stock drama rarely touched normal lives? But as you grew older, you found it did.
As I came to know more and more people, found that in most of their lives there was something which was definitely on the dramatic side.
Yeah.
After all, life is the fundamental drama.
It is. It's dramatic, but it's not pointed up the way fiction is, I've decided.
Well, in fiction, you simply leave out the undramatic parts.
And that, otherwise, it would be as dull as life often is, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Fiction.
Since I wrote this, I finished another book, which is about the most ordinary people in the world, whose life was intensely dramatic.
What sort of people were they?
Well, I don't want to go into that.
Honestly, I knew he was going to say
it. It took me 50,000 words to write it, and it would take me at least an hour and a half to explain it.
Well, may I just explain one little thing to you? You see, by the time you've written it and it gets in the book form, then you forget the one you've just done. So when I ask you back when the other one comes out, you will have forgotten it. But then now's the only time we ever will hear anything from you about it.
What you should be asking me is what the book I'm going to write in 1956 is going to be about.
Well, what is it?
Well, as a matter of fact, I think very seriously at that time writing a book about adolescence.
In 1956?
I think by that time I'll be just the right age to understand it.
Should I ask him now how old he is now?
I don't think so, no. He wouldn't answer you anyway.
No, he certainly wouldn't, and I shudder to think what he would say.
You remember you got me started the last time I was here, and they almost had to cut us off the air.
What did you say last time?
You got me mad, and I swore. You remember that?
I got you mad?
Well, you got me talking about something about which I felt strongly.
Not politics, I hope.
Well, it may have been.
It was a little political. Yes, I remember.
Yes, I seem to recall.
Sorry the subject came up, Archie. It's been a good deal better if we just let that
Better go. Left unsaid.
Yeah. So we're about to have a couple of conventions. Yeah.
Why two?
Hmm?
Why two?
Why I have two conventions?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you better change the subject, Vincent. You have this a book on adolescence that you're going to write, Ben Ames, will you? Why do you want to write a book on adolescence, apart from the fact that you think by then you'll understand adolescence?
Well, I've wanted to ever since I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been tried, and tried with tremendous effect in this book, Peter Dominic. May I be forgiven for recommending another book?
Well, I think it's very generous of you.
There's a very swell book recently published about adolescence, and if you haven't read it, you ought to read it.
What's its name?
Peter Dominic.
Peter Dominic. Who wrote it?
I don't remember offhand.
It's the first novel by somebody or other. I haven't got its name.
Well, I certainly will.
But it's a book which is well worth reading.
Do you think that adolescents are tortured in their souls? Do they suffer?
Well, of course. No human being suffers so much, you know, as a 6-month-old baby, unless it may be a 3-month-old baby. There's no possible torment so great as that which is expressed by a baby's cry.
I think they just
see, their sense of perspective isn't as even as ours. So when anything happens to them, they think this is the ultimate catastrophe. As you grow older, of course, your susceptibility to torment decreases. You become calloused. And perhaps at adolescence, you are capable of greater suffering than at any other time in your life.
You haven't got
because
a callous.
You still have the lack of perspective which goes with youth, and the beginning of understanding which enables you to get the shades of suffering that you couldn't get when you were younger and that you won't get when you're older.
That's very beautiful. Well, I'll look forward to that 1956 novel of adolescence. No,
I'd like to come on the air with you and we'll discuss it.
How many years is that, Vincent?
12 years off, that's all. We will have just finished our 22nd birthday party in Madison Square Garden and the Yankee Stadium and a few other places.
We're going to have Yankee Stadium and other places for annexes next time. So we invite you to be a guest. How's the Mary Margaret McBride Rose doing?
I was delighted to find that the 6 which I planted last fall came through the winter excellently and are thriving.
Hardy country rose, that's what
yes.
we are.
The only trouble is that, I hesitate to say this, but they were all labeled. I planted about 18 roses in a row. and somebody during the winter stole three, and the ones they stole were not those labeled Mary Margaret McBride.
Well, I had
a lot of the people down in Maine are very ignorant, you see.
I'm glad for you still to have your six. But I do feel a little hurt and slighted all the same. But
well, it just goes to show that that's a rural district.
But you hurt me, too, about Maine. I thought Maine was the most honest place in the world. I didn't think anybody ever stole anything there, even a rose.
Well, you know, when a person sees something they really want and can take it, the temptation is pretty severe.
Mm-hmm. Is this a personal remark?
No.
Huh?
No,
just a philosophical observation on life.
Yes, you have to have a certain sense of social inhibitions to refrain from stealing when you have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live in a small town, those inhibitions are not always so strong.
What do you really
think? How do we get on these subjects?
No, now you've started me thinking about something. I often wrestle with myself on the subject of motives and what prompts you to be good occasionally and then suddenly break out and be just as bad as you can. Do you think it's just do you think that we're governed more by fear than anything else?
Well, I think it's largely a question of digestion.
So when your digestion's good, you just rip-roaring or as bad as you can be. When your digestion is bad, you feel you're about to meet your maker, and so you don't.
No, I think the converse is true.
You do?
When your digestion is bad, you come home and kick the cat.
Well, that may be.
When your digestion is good, you behave yourself. But when your digestion is bad, you seek release in some way.
No, I disagree with you. I don't believe that people with bad digestions go out and steal.
Oh, but they misbehave in other ways.
Yes, they're cross and cranky and crabbed, which is perhaps worse.
Worse, much worse.
Are you advocating stealing above being cross?
Well, I'm an expert at both, so I don't think we'd better go into that.
One of these days, you know, he will really stop coming on my air. He will begin to think that he commits himself too far. You're awfully cagey, though. What do you suppose makes you so cagey?
Years of experience.
Mm-hmm. Would you be as cagey if, say, Vincent were asking you questions, do you think?
I wouldn't answer any questions anybody asked me except you.
Yeah, that gives you a sense of achievement, Mary Margaret. You've done better than anybody else could have.
Well, I think, Vincent, with that, we'll just remind everybody that this guest today is Ben Ames Williams. Williams, just the way you'd expect it to be spelled, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S. And his latest book is Leave Her to Heaven. And The Strange Woman, as I remember, is still a bestseller after 3 or 4 years, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, she's so diabolical. And Ellen is just as diabolical. I just feel that I want really to tell him what happened to Ellen, and since you don't remember, I might as well, but I won't.
Well, I feel I want to tell them this is station WEAF New York, to which they are listening,
and
also to mention the fact that we're going out to Morristown, New Jersey next Tuesday afternoon to do our 1 o'clock broadcast from there. We're broadcasting from the Historical Museum at Morristown. Admission to the broadcast is by ticket, and the tickets may be obtained from the Chief of Police, the Chief of Police of Morristown, who will have the tickets available for you any time of the morning, afternoon, or evening.
Therefore, we'll be sure to have in our audience only people with good digestions, because nobody else will go near the police department.
I guess that's right. You can get your tickets starting Thursday morning. That's tomorrow morning, and we suggest that you get there early to ask for tickets.
Mm-hmm. You seem to know more about it than I do, Mr. Conley.
Well, I just found it out within the last 5 minutes, so I can't lay any great claim to knowledge.
I thought we ought to be very serious about our sponsors today. Seems so long since I've talked about them, doesn't it to you?
Yes, we kind of glossed them over lightly there for a few days.
You see, I really love my sponsors. I really think they're wonderful people, wonderful products. I appreciate more than anything in the world that's ever happened to me the letters that have come during our 10th anniversary celebration, where you all said, as a birthday present to you, Mary Margaret, I went out and bought every single product of yours that I could get. And not only did I buy it now, but I always buy it by them. And I'm going to keep replenishing my supply. Now, that's really wonderful. And then you added the thing that makes me even happier. You said, you know why? Not just because we're fond of you and Vincent, but because when you recommend a product, it always turns out to be just the way you said it would be. So.
You couldn't ask for anything more than that, could you?
You take the Bohack stores. Mrs. Hubbercamp wins $5 worth of Bohack merchandise today, riding from Bayshore, Long Island, about the Bohack stores. Her fourth son may be in Italy. Not in Italy, but in France right now. I don't know where he is, but he's overseas somewhere. And she is taking care of the four children of another son who is doing war work in a distant place, and his wife is with him. Well, she was a listener to our program, but there was no Bohacks near her. She was very dissatisfied with the store where she was buying, so she decided to find the Bohacks if it killed her. And she said, "Believe me, I'm glad I went exploring. Such a variety of all my favorite brands, fresh vegetables, delicious meats, courteous, helpful clerks, store roomy and clean, and all under one roof at no extra cost. It seems like fiction. Dealing there is ample reward for the extra walk, and I'm looking forward to taking my daughter there when she comes home. I guess it's her son-in-law who's doing war work. I bought most of your products there, Smith's split peas. Say, by the way, Vincent, the other night when we were dining with the Auslanders, you know, Joseph Auslander, the poet, his wife eats soup last.
She does.
She eats up her meal, and then she orders soup.
Very attractive woman otherwise.
Beautiful woman. Wonderful poet. Don't you think that's a good idea?
I'm not sure.
She just does not want a sweet, and so she has soup.
Well?
And I thought, why, there's Smith's three-minute mix. You see, you could decide that you just had to have soup when you'd finished your meal, and it only takes 3 minutes to do the three-minute mix. And it has that wonderful split pea flavor, Smith's split pea. Remember me telling you how Smith's split peas are grown in a special part of the United States there in the Northwest, so they get a special rain and special climate? And they're different, that's all. They're like all my products, just different. And this three-minute mix has a different flavor. Oh, well, then Mrs. Hoverkamp says that she has dromedary. That's the mix, you know, that you take out of the package. Say you want to make cupcakes. You mix a cup of water with it, and then you just pour it into cupcake pans after you've mixed. And you don't have to put in any spices, sugar, shortening, anything. Dromedary is it's Mary Washington's own recipe. She was the mother of George Washington.
She certainly was.
Mm-hmm. And sweetheart soap, Mrs. Hoverkamp says she gets. That's that fragrant oval cake that doesn't waste away and is so economical, makes a wonderful lather, is good for even the most fragile baby skin. Did you ever try it for shampoos? Good for that, too. Says she got Knox on at Bohack's. I wasn't sure about that. That's the creamy liquid that you use on your silver services. Well, and I got the most beautiful silver spoon, Vincent, from a listener. It was her great-grandmother's.
Hmm.
It's thin and worn, and I'll use Noxon on it without any fear because it will not scratch, and you just rub it on, rub it off, and the whole thing's done. She got Hemo there, too. That's Borden's Hemo. You know Elsie the cow and Borden's Hemo? Well, that has vitamins A, B1, B2, D, niacin, and minerals, iron, phosphorus,
and calcium.
He just loves that. He loves to get in a mineral. And it's a chocolatey drink, this Hemo, H-E-M-O. It's a chocolatey drink, and you enjoy drinking your vitamins and minerals. That's really good, you know. And she says, Van Camp's, but the other night I cooked Goodman's egg noodles with cheese for the children. I wish you could have seen them eat. Tommy had four helpings, and then he said, "Gee, Gran, we certainly have swell things to eat. I'm glad you found that new store. That's Bohack."
Mm-hmm. That's Bohack's. Do you have a Bohack special, or is this the wrong day
for it? Florida Valencia oranges, extra large and juicy, 5 pounds for 35 cents. Florida Valencia oranges, tomorrow at all Bohack stores. She didn't put in Fanny Farmer, did she?
No, she didn't.
Well, the Fanny Farmer people are still asking us to save paper. There are 700,000 different items being shipped to the Army that are wrapped or boxed in paper. That means the demand for paper has increased enormously. So when you buy Fanny Farmer old-time candies, those luscious, creamy, rich candies that still have the same quality, though you can't get as many of them, and you buy Salto nut meats in the Fanny Farmer shops, save paper, and buy war stamps, and do all the other things that you ought to do, that it's your duty to do. And then here's the Fleischer Yarns. I like to be very serious about Fleischer Yarns. Now, there's some more integrity. 77 years, those Fleischer people have been making the very best yarns, testing them, trying them, making them so that you can knit sweaters, knit lovely, soft, downy little things for babies. Generations have had Fleischer things. and your favorite needlework counter would have books of, that are illustrated and all the flasher yarns and all the directions and all the tools for using them. Vincent has a flasher sweater.
I have. I'm very proud of it, too.
People wrote that they were certainly glad to realize it wasn't a myth when I held it up, but they were disappointed you didn't wear it.
Yes. Well, it was a little warm in there, I felt.
I wish we could have had sandwiches of enriched tip-top bread for everybody there. Wouldn't that have been wonderful?
Would have been nice.
You could have handed out peanut butter, and I'd have handed out mashed up ham. Not mashed
up,
that
put on the sandwich, on the bread.
Yeah, with pickle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have had enriched tip-top bread with all the vitamins and minerals, and that wonderful crust and a flavor. Really an awfully good bread, enriched tip-top bread. It's a new loaf that our enriched tip-top people made, especially when we went to war. Because they wanted to put more nourishment. They wanted to put more vitamins, more minerals, more everything. Have you, some of you did compare it with other loaves, and you've written me that you like it a lot better, and those of you who didn't, I'll be glad to hear from you. What's the matter, Vincent? Do you want Onco?
Yes, I was just...
Say, do you think Gimbel's have Onco?
I'm not certain. I believe they have.
Put us in an advertisement.
Did they?
Wasn't that nice?
Mm-hmm.
About our birthday party. Right into their ads in the New York papers, they put us.
That was very nice of them, indeed.
They're sweet. Well, anyhow, they ought to have Onco because it's 100% Carnauba wax. You know what that is? That's that palm tree that gives off on its leaf this wax. It's the hardest wax you ever... I haven't read Mr. Hewitt's letter.
No, you haven't.
And I keep saying nobody in the world would ever buy anything for floors or furniture except ONCO if I ever read Mr. Hewitt's letter, because he has this laboratory and he tested it and he's very honest. He's Peter Cooper's grandson. Ben Ames Williams is laughing at me. Why do people laugh at me?
I can't understand it.
You're wonderful.
M.J. Creed in Chester, Pennsylvania is carrying Onco, and Russell E. Smith in Millville, New Jersey is carrying Onco.
You haven't said a word about Bulldog Blue or Dazzle.
Neither have you.
Well,
what do you want to say about them?
Well, Bulldog Blue is our liquid car. I bet Ben Ames Williams remembers about it. The Bulldog's picture on the front. I think we said something about Yale, where you didn't go, did you? But it's a liquid concentrated bluing that goes a long, long way.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dazzle is a bleach. And everybody needs a bleach. And we buy our Dazzle in the quart-sized bottle.
Why?
Well, because it's more economical.
That's right.
And if your dealer doesn't have Bulldog Blue, would you please write me his name and address? It's a very extra special... Say, I went to a wedding yesterday, 2 days ahead of time up at West Point.
Well, you went to the pet show 10 days ahead of time, so you're getting closer all the time.
Yeah, Thursday, General Omar Bradley's daughter, you know, whose mother is an old school friend of mine, is getting married. But I went yesterday.
It was just announced today that General Bradley is in France, you know.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and that woman... My friend Mary Bradley is a brave, fine woman. Here's her only child, just getting married to a West Point graduate, who will have 1 month of holiday, and then he's geared for war. And there's her husband, General Long. I'm going to have her on the program, Mary Bradley. Don't you think so?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to tell Vincent. Let me tell about all the brides that were up there, and the rice at the Thayer Hotel, and the little shops just full of wedding cakes, and the florists just sending out one bridal bouquet after another. You know, they marry them at the rate of about one every 5 minutes.
Have you finished now?
And I went to a wedding after all, Vincent.
Mary Margaret Bride will be back again tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. This is Vincent Connolly speaking.
Mary Margaret McBride's program is a WEAF feature presentation.